This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and our prayers this hour and all day to the folks running today's emotional Boston Marathon. May you all finish, and here's hoping your times all improve. And if this is your first marathon, best of luck to all of you. Later this hour, a mathematician does not want to disprove the existence of God, but he does want science and spirituality to get along better. We'll have a conversation about that. And we want to hear your views on all of that. You can reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post a comment at thetakeaway.org. The broadcast networks are not happy about the streaming service Aereo, and arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court this week are not expected to help them get along. But first, we go to Ukraine. Diplomats signed what was called a de-escalation agreement last week, but armed militia and Ukrainian military forces on the ground have managed to keep tensions high over the weekend. Vice President Joe Biden begins a two-day visit to the region today amidst reports that at least three people were killed in a shootout on Sunday at a checkpoint run by pro-Russian militants. And the bodies of two more people were pulled from the Donetsk River in eastern Ukraine. Joining me now is Angela Stent, director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Professor, welcome to The Takeaway.
Good to be on your show.
This is a very difficult situation. First of all, where do you think we stand right now? An agreement signed in Geneva, but the facts on the ground very different.
Yes, I think there's not only not been any de-escalation since that agreement was signed, there's been escalation. Clearly, both sides have a very different view of what that agreement means. I think the U.S., the Ukrainians, the European Union believed it would mean that the separatists, the militants who've taken over buildings in eastern Ukraine would give up the buildings, they would lay down their arms, and there'd be a peaceful resolution. What the Russian foreign minister, Mr. Lavrov, said today is that no, it means that the people in Kiev who are still out in the square, who are armed in the Maidan, that they should be disarmed and give up their positions. So there's a stalemate there. And meanwhile, as you said, there have been casualties. People have died in eastern Ukraine. It's unclear. The separatists blame nationalists, right-wing nationalists from the West for killing people. The Ukrainian government and others say, no, these are actually Russian provocateurs who are dressed up as Ukrainian nationalists. So we don't really know what the facts on the ground are, but what we do know is that there's been no de-escalation.
And there's a logic problem in that Geneva agreement in the sense that if the nationalists in eastern Ukraine, the pro-Kremlin forces in eastern Ukraine, had simply put down their weapons at the command of Vladimir Putin, it would have said to the world, well, he was controlling them all along. It seems as though there's almost more of an incentive for violence to go on because the Russians can say, hey, we don't control these people at all.
Yeah, well, that's exactly been the Russians' line. We have nothing to do with them. And it's never been clear since that agreement was signed who is supposed to disarm the separatists in the east of Ukraine. Not clear at all about how that's done. The Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE, does have a monitoring group there, but they're unarmed. And all they can do is go around and inspect things and talk to people, but that's not going to get these very heavily armed and well-organized separatists out of the buildings.
And the Organization for Cooperation and Security in Europe that you just described, that unarmed organization was denied access to eastern Ukraine. During the Cold War, there was a whole infrastructure for monitoring troop buildups, troop movements, nuclear forces. Do we have to re-examine that infrastructure, maybe actually retool it for this particular conflict?
I think we do because those structures actually worked pretty well during the Cold War. There were rules of the game. There were monitoring missions. Now that Russia has upended all these rules of the game by annexing Crimea and by threatening eastern Ukraine by having its forces massed there and created this atmosphere of instability and unpredictability, I think we do need to go back to the drawing board and say, how can we rebuild confidence measures here? But it means that all sides would have to be willing to agree to a structure whereby you would have a better sense of what's happening.
Now, some editorial pages around the world are suggesting that the Obama administration is returning to the language of containment, which I'm sure is something very familiar to you as a student of the Cold War. But the containment strategy that the West, and particularly the United States, adopted for much of the Cold War basically ceded Eastern Europe to the Russians and the Soviets. So containment isn't necessarily great news for the people of Ukraine.
Well, I agree with you. Yes, as a recovering Sovietologist, the concept of containment is familiar. But you're right. That was based on the Yalta settlement, which, of course, for the people in Eastern Europe is something that they greatly dislike because it meant the division of Europe. And that there is this question. Ukraine is obviously very important to Russia. Russia has very strong interests there for reasons that we've seen in the past few weeks. It does not carry the same importance, certainly for the United States. And for Europe, it's their neighbor, and they are concerned about what's happening there. But the fundamental question, as you say, is do we at some point have to acknowledge what Mr. Putin, of course, is claiming, that this area, including Ukraine, all of the former Soviet space, constitutes Russia's sphere of privileged interest. Now, obviously, we're never going to agree to that formally, but de facto, is that what we're going to see going forward? That there will be an agreement that Ukraine will remain neutral, will not seek to join NATO, and that will also not seek to have a close association with the European Union, which is precisely what the Russians want.
Well, 100 years after the beginning of the World War I, the Great War, it's probably important that world leaders know the difference between a trigger that's being disarmed and a move that basically appeases a tyrant and leads to greater conflict. Would a partition of Ukraine, a basic acceptance of territorial rights to Russia in eastern Ukraine, be the disarming of a trigger or some sort of appeasement that would lead to further problems?
Well, it might, in the short run, solve the problem of the concern about a military conflict, but it could also embolden Russia in other parts of the former Soviet Union, where there are large Russian-speaking and Russian minorities, to go further. So I think that would be, a rather dangerous step to take.
Angela Stent is director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University, author of The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. Thanks so much.
Good to be on your show.
So more grim details as the recovery effort continues at the site of the sunken South Korean ferry that went down last week with hundreds aboard. The government in Seoul has called for strict punishment of the ferry crew members, including the captain, who reportedly abandoned ship, leaving passengers to fend for themselves in the cold waters. More than 200 passengers still missing. Joining us once again from Seoul is Stephen Borowick, reporter for the LA Times. Stephen, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
You predicted last week that the scenarios that would emerge over the next several days, at least from when we last spoke with you, would focus on foul play and negligence on the part of the ferry captain and crew, and that's exactly what's happened. What can they do about it now, the government?
There were four more arrests that were made today, and there's going to be a lot of questioning that takes place, and where we go from there really depends on what comes out of interrogation of the people who are involved.
Have the conditions for recovery and salvage of the ferry changed at all? Is it still just as difficult as you described it a few days ago?
The weather has improved somewhat, but what the big change has been is it's now been 5 days since the ship initially went down, and any hope of finding survivors is all but gone. So one change that we're likely to see over the next few days is the government making some kind of formal recognition that the rescue operation is no longer feasible and turning towards making more efforts to actually raise the ship out of the water.
And so they are still technically calling this a rescue operation. It hasn't shifted just to the notion of recovery.
That's right. And there's a big psychological implication there, as I mentioned, which formally calling off the rescue operation means an explicit acceptance of the fact that there are no more survivors. And as we talked about last week, there are a lot of very distraught family members that, despite the tall odds in the case, are perhaps not ready to make that admission.
Stephen Borowick, who is responsible for the safety of the ferry system, the elaborate ferry system in South Korea? Is it a government response? Is there a National Transportation Safety Board kind of government oversight of vessels of this kind? And is angst and emotion on the part of these families likely to be directed at the government in Seoul as time goes on?
Well, it's both. The South Korean system is not unlike the systems in other countries where these are private firms that operate, but they, of course, are only able to operate with under government regulations and with government licenses. And so in the fallout to this disaster, it's a combination of the public's displeasure is a combination of anger at the company for not being better prepared and for not executing the operation more effectively, but also at the government for what is seen as a lack of attention to safety. The question being, if this company was operating fully licensed, which it was, why did the government not pick up on this? And why was this company allowed to operate in the way that they did?
Is there any clarity of the messages that were delivered to people on board the ship right after it clearly was in danger? Some people were told to stay in place. That seems to have been a fatal decision. Others decided to get out as quickly as possible. Who got one message and who got the other?
There does seem to be a lot of confusion. What's coming out now are transcripts of the discussions that were taking place between the Sewol Ferry and the different disaster response facilities that were on board, which are the Coast Guard. But the Coast Guard is kind of filtered through these sort of maritime traffic control centers. So there has been stories of the Sewol making requests for assistance and them not going through, and the Sewol deciding that since those rescue boats hadn't gotten there yet, it actually might have been safer to not tell the passengers to vacate onto the deck because there were high waves. And the captain has said that he was concerned that if the passengers were told to go out onto the deck, they could be swept away into an area of very high currents. So it's still too early to sort through all of this contradictory information that's out right now. So we're still waiting for what you would call clarity.
Finally, who have you spoken with who has absolute faith or is holding on to faith that their loved one is going to be found inside the hull of that ship underwater?
I've not spoken to anyone who is that optimistic. I went to the Danwon High School about an hour south of Seoul on Friday, and I do feel like people there are putting on a very brave face, but the factual evidence is mounting, and I don't think anyone can rationally hold on to hope of survivors for very much longer, if indeed they still are now.
Speaking to us from Seoul, South Korea, and thinking about the tragedy in that South Korean ferry disaster, Stephen Borowick is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much, Stephen.
Nice talking to you, John.
Coming up, the testing of faith and the search for scientific truth.
Hello, my name is Brian Jones, and I am from Westland, Michigan. Faith to me is believing that a higher power, in this case God, will handle all situations that I can't handle, or having a belief that God will handle situations that I don't understand. I was out of work for most of summer, like 7 or 8 months, but instead of lamenting and stressing out, I just believe that God will handle all of my situations, and He did. Now I'm back to work.
Who's handling all of your situations? When things work out well, it's easy to believe in a higher power. How much more challenging is it when bad things happen? Tell us your story. Later this hour, how proving or disproving the existence of God is not persuasive to believers. Keep the faith with us at 877-8-BY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. And now, making a federal case out of how you get your TV.
There is absolutely no reason why, for a consumer to have a basic lifeline service, that they should be forced to take a cable bundle of hundreds of channels because they just want 5, 6, or 10 channels.
That's entrepreneur and media iconoclast Chet Kanojia. He's made this technological truth the basis for his company, Aereo. And just as he argued on this program earlier this year, Aereo uses the digital broadcast signal of the major networks and local broadcast channels to provide low-cost access to network content along with stream channels, bypassing cable providers and making the argument that any broadcast signal is fair game for his company's service. This case is about copyright law, digital technology, and the definition of free access, and it pits the biggest moguls in television against each other before the Supreme Court this week. Among them, Les Moonves of CBS Television versus Barry Diller of IAC and a financial backer of Aereo. Rebecca Tushnet is a professor at Georgetown Law School. Welcome, Professor.
Hi.
So let's keep the media personalities out of this for a moment. Will the Supreme Court be able to resolve something that involves so much technical definitions of what is a broadcast signal, whether it's digital or analog, that sort of thing?
Well, the great thing about being the Supreme Court is that they can give us an answer. I suspect that depending on what the answer is, Congress might be asked to revisit the issue, but that's an accepted part of copyright law. Sometimes Congress does go back in and change things.
How is copyright law protecting a broadcast signal that's through the air that anyone can pull down any more than it would have protected a signal that the FCC regulated, a few decades ago?
Well, the argument is that Aereo is publicly performing the broadcasts, and public performance requires the consent of the copyright owner in this kind of situation, or at least payment of retransmission fees, according to the broadcasters. That's precisely what's up for debate.
And what's Aereo's argument here in that it doesn't need to pay any of that money?
Aereo's argument is that it uses hundreds of tiny little antennas. Each person gets their own dedicated one and makes their own copy and transmission, the same way you would with your DVR or the same way you would with an antenna on the top of your own house. Those aren't public performances, and Aereo says it's just aggregating a whole bunch of private performances and not making a public one.
So what are people paying for when they get the Aereo service, as far as the Supreme Court is concerned and this intellectual property question is concerned?
They're paying for the convenience of getting the broadcast streamed to their personal devices, so your cell phone or your computer.
And in the case of Aereo's argument before the Supreme Court, they will say that consumers don't have to use their service, they could actually get it free on their own and force the networks to make a case that even that is a violation of copyright law.
Well, putting an antenna on your own house is very clearly not a violation. And the Supreme Court has also held that time shifting for personal use is a fair use, and so not a violation of copyright law if you use a DVR or VCR in your home. The real question is whether aggregating it changes it into something that's different in kind and switches it over into a public performance.
Now, in terms of where the court stands on this, there's a fairly longstanding impatience of the Roberts Court with Congress for not making laws clearer. That could be the outcome here. The question of whether they come down on intellectual property rights versus the power of the cable companies, which is what Aereo is arguing. Is there any precedent, any sort of pattern here which might indicate where the court would rule?
I think this one is a real toss-up because the statute, which was written a long time ago before the internet was working in anything like the way it works now, really just doesn't take into this situation into account. You can read the statute either way to support either side. Both sides' positions have problems and lead to sort of weird results. So it is very much a question of individual preconceptions. And I don't think that there's a clear legal answer.
So the court could declare that any stream that comes across your computer is equivalent to a broadcast signal, which would really transform the landscape and make it more difficult for Congress to resolve this. What's the sort of worst case scenario from a lawyer's standpoint in terms of a decision making things more confused rather than less?
Well, I think the worst case scenario is something that throws cloud computing into doubt, because many of the arguments the broadcasters are making would apply equally to Dropbox or Amazon Cloud or many other services that people use to back up their own stuff. And that, I think, is really the worst case, that Aereo would lose under this broad theory.
But the FCC has already been told that it doesn't have the power to regulate the internet. So it would seem that cloud is safe for right now based on the way the Supreme Court has ruled already.
Well, the cloud is the FCC's jurisdiction is different from copyright law. So the question is whether broadcasters, music companies, and so on will be able to go after companies like Dropbox and say, okay, you have to pay us $1 billion or you can't operate.
It's really amazing just the extent to which the landscape has changed just in the last 10 years, where we're talking about copyright regulations, the question of whether a broadcast is a stream, the whole cloud. I mean, there's almost no relationship to when the original law was written, right?
Well, they thought that they were legislating for the future, and it just turned out that there was too much industry-specific regulation in the law for it to really persist unchanged. And probably is time to comprehensively rethink copyright and stop dividing rights so finely. But that's going to be very hard to do. The cable companies have their own separate regulation. The satellite companies have their own separate regulation within the copyright law. So the amount of interest that it will take to change things is pretty daunting.
Remarkable. Finally, before we go, is there a particular justice, Rebecca Tushnet, who is particularly geeky on this subject, who is an expert, who loves to talk and, throw terms around?
That would be Justice Breyer.
So we expect him to have a very active role here.
Absolutely.
Rebecca Tushnet is a professor at Georgetown Law School on the Aereo case, the copyright issues of which go before the U.S. Supreme Court this week. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. One of the most dangerous places in the world suffered its worst tragedy late last week. An avalanche on Mount Everest on a climbing route for the world's highest peak killed at least 13 Nepalese guides. The Sherpa guides were working at just under 21,000 feet, fixing ropes and preparing the path for climbers ahead of peak mountaineering season. Joining me now is Ellen Barry, South Asia Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times. Ellen, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
In many ways, the Sherpas rely on the mountain climbing industry because this is a way of life there, but they work under extraordinarily difficult and dangerous conditions. And that's what this accident says almost more than anything else.
That's right. They've obviously lived with these conditions for many years, but I think just the magnitude of the loss of life from Friday's accident has prompted very unusual decisions from a group of Sherpas who met last night at the base camp and essentially voted to propose a work stoppage that could conceivably end the expedition, all the expeditions for 2014.
How dependent are mountain climbers on the Sherpas, and how far back does that dependence go?
It goes back as far as Sir Edmund Hillary, so, the better part of a century. Sherpas have served as guides, but increasingly they serve perhaps more as workhorses carrying gear from the base camp up to the camps up the mountain. So I think the vast majority of those Sherpas working on the mountain this season are carrying loads or fixing lines, and the Sherpas who died on Friday were carrying loads.
Would you say that this constitutes a move to unionize the Sherpas on some level, or have they always been organized on some level, even going back to some celebrated disasters and fatalities in the past two decades?
I have the sense that this is part of a negotiation with the Nepali government on issues of compensation and insurance and how to distribute the profits that the government makes off expeditions, which are, as you know, multi-million dollar affairs every year. And some Sherpa organizations have made specific demands for hiking the level of compensation to a little bit more than double what the government is offering now. But it's obviously a very powerful emotional moment. And one thing that is very telling is that some of the big international expeditions, including the Discovery Channel expedition and several other very large outfits, have put out announcements saying they're canceling their expeditions. And the sunk costs, economic and psychological, involved in canceling an expedition are really quite staggering.
Finally, is there any sense that the mountain, because of climate changes or just different kinds of weather patterns, has become a more dangerous place on some level, more prone to these kinds of events?
I think what you hear is that places like the icefall that these Sherpas were crossing are really the most dangerous parts of the mountain. And the Sherpas cross it many, many times. And one of their functions is to secure it. Everyone who crosses that area tries to do it as fast as possible. On this occasion, we were told by a survivor yesterday, there were a couple broken ladders. So you had a backup, basically a traffic jam. And they just couldn't get through that very dangerous place fast enough. So I think, you know, one thing that you could talk about is how to make these passages safer for the Sherpas who spend much more time there than the international clients. But, you know, most people regard an avalanche as bad luck, and I've heard that from many people as well.
Ellen Berry, South Asia Bureau Chief for our partner, The New York Times, speaking to us from Delhi about the tragedy on Mount Everest. Ellen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, the Retro Report documentary team looks at a case about the right to die, when life ends, and who has the right to end it. The question in 2005 of whether a woman's life was worth living and just who would get to decide that became a national issue, not a private family matter, for Michael Schiavo, his wife Terry, and Terry's family.
It was to a point where Terry wasn't going to function. There was nothing more, and they told us. Her mother was sitting right there at the time. There was nothing more they can do for Terry.
That's Michael Schiavo speaking about his wife Terry, and the precise-sounding medical designation, persistent vegetative state, was the threshold for denying Terry Schiavo treatment and allowing her to die, something her family went to court to stop.
People think Terry was in a coma, she was brain dead, that she was terminal. Terry was not dying. Terry had a profound brain injury, and our family wanted to care for her just the way she was.
That's Terry's brother, Bobby Schindler, recalling the issues that made this case a national story and launched a debate that continues today. We're joined by Retro Report producer Miriam Weintraub. Miriam, welcome.
Hello.
So remind us of the most important detail. Terry Schiavo left our world in 2005 at the end of March, right?
Yeah, March 31st, 2005.
And this was after treatment was denied and this worked its way through the courts.
Yeah, but she actually collapsed in 1990, and a lot of people don't know that. This was a 15-year experience for her and probably about a 7-year battle between her husband and her family.
What pushed this into national consciousness and even got President George W. Bush involved?
You know, this was a kind of a quiet little family affair going on in Florida between the husband and the family, who, by the way, got along well initially. They got along well for the first few years, and then it sort of they took a split about 4 years after her collapse. In what actually pushed it nationally, I think, really would be that the first time her feeding tube was removed, Florida Governor Jeb Bush got involved, and he actually passed a law called Terry's Law. That actually is when all of a sudden we started to hear about it on the national level, and then it escalated from there.
And when the president got involved, he suggested that there were all kinds of uncertainties in the case, in a sense, preempting the question of whether she was absolutely in a persistent vegetative state. What did the courts decide, and how difficult was it for experts to determine what was going on in the mind of or brain of Terry Schiavo?
The courts were very clear. The courts basically said that Terry Schiavo had expressed a wish to Michael Schiavo and to a few others in his family that she didn't want to live in this condition. And it always came back to that. There were questions that were raised, and the family certainly raised questions about whether or not she was in a persistent vegetative state. They believed then and remain firm now that Terry responded to them. Bobby Schindler insists, and he feels it in his heart, that when his mother walked in the room, Terry knew she was there, and that Terry looked up, and that Terry laughed at her father's jokes. And they felt it then, and they believe it today. On the other hand, the experts were fairly clear that she was in a persistent vegetative state. And I think part of the problem in this story is that the persistent vegetative state is so little understood. It's a confusing diagnosis. The person looks awake. They look at you. They look around the room. They have sleep cycles. They have wake cycles. They cry. They have tears. And it's a very confusing diagnosis. But the courts again and again said they believed that she had expressed her wishes, that she didn't want to live in this condition. And once that decision was made, it sort of went back to that again and again and again.
Is the legacy of this case today the raising of the profile of medical proxies and making those wishes clear prior to some tragedy happening?
Absolutely. I think that especially when it was going on, the number of people who were looking into living wills went up by thousandfold. Unfortunately, from the research I did, it doesn't seem like that stuck. The numbers, as I understand it, which isn't completely clear, but the numbers, as I understand it, have gone back to what they were even before Terri Schiavo. And when you talk to people about the Terri Schiavo case, they talk about what they would want done. But in reality, people don't go about the business of making their living will. It's just something we don't do. So the numbers are back to what they were even before Terri, which is about 25%. About 1 in 4 Americans have living wills or advanced directives.
Looking back at the implications of the Terri Schiavo case back in 2005, Miriam Weintraub is a producer for the Retro Report documentary project. Thanks so much, Miriam.
Thank you.
Persistent vegetative state is a medical designation that has been around in some form since the 1800s. Yet what does it describe? The autopsy report of Terri Schiavo in 2005 declared that her brain injury from an oxygen deprivation incident in 1990 was irreversible, and that autopsy report supported the court decisions to withdraw Terri Schiavo's life support. Adrian Owen is a cognitive neuroscientist and professor at Western University in Canada. He joins us today from his home in London, Ontario. Welcome, Professor.
Hello there.
What are we talking about when we say persistent vegetative state? And with diagnostic tools in the brain, can we actually see a lot of different states that can be described in some form as vegetative inside the brain?
Well, certainly we can. And actually, technology is changing the situation very quickly. Typically, when we talk about persistent vegetative state, what we mean is a patient who is awake but unaware. So they'll open their eyes. They may even seem to look around the room. They go to sleep at night sometimes, but they seem to be completely unaware. And by that, I mean, you cannot attract their attention with a noise or ask them to look at something or address them in any way and expect a response. But that's the long-term clinical picture, and that's the way that it's been for many years. Recently, neuroimaging tools, things like fMRI, so-called functional magnetic resonance imaging, is being used to show that some of these patients have some residual abilities that were simply not detectable at the bedside. So even though they appear to be unaware, some of them may turn out to have some level of awareness in the fMRI scanner.
Now, the fMRI actually tracks blood flow, so the neural activity is sort of linked to the blood flow. When you say abilities and awareness, what kinds of things are we talking about?
I'll begin with the extreme case, if you like, and this is something that doesn't occur very often, but we're seeing it now in about 20% of our patients. The analogy I like to use is the clinical one, that when you're trying to establish whether a patient is aware, often you'll say, well, squeeze my hand, and the patient may not be able to do it. But what we do is we put the patient in the scanner and we say, imagine this scenario or that scenario. And these are scenarios that we know are linked to particular changes in fMRI activity in the brain. So one very simple one is to ask patients to imagine that they're playing a game of tennis. And it may seem like a rather strange thing to do, but we do it because that tends to get people to imagine waving their arms around as though they had a tennis racket, and that activates the motor regions of the brain. So the analogy there is, instead of asking a patient to raise their arm, we're asking them to imagine moving their arm, and we can detect that imaginary response. Now, although it's an imaginary response, it's still a response, and in that sense, it can still indicate awareness or some residual awareness, because the patient is doing what we ask them to do, albeit with their brain rather than their body.
All right. Is it possible, though, that within the brain there are hierarchies of these kinds of responses, just in the same way that the body may look like it's responding, but if it's a reflex, it actually doesn't constitute consciousness? Could the same thing be going on in the brain?
That's absolutely certainly the case. So, for example, many of these patients, and I think it's close to the majority, will have very simple reflexive brain responses, to use your terminology. So if, for example, we play the patient speech, we will see activity in the so-called speech areas of the brain, that the parts of the brain that we know process language. Now, we know that doesn't mean that all of these patients understand speech and are processing it and could respond. It's because speech responses, at least the brain's response to speech, is an automatic one. It's not exactly reflexive, but it's automatic. You can't turn your brain off from listening to speech. So, yes, there is a hierarchy of responses, and that's why at the lower levels, things like automatic reflexive responses, we see this in many, many patients, and we don't conclude too much, to be honest. But these higher level responses, where the person is actively generating a brain state, is something that occurs really in a much smaller number of patients.
You know, the huge takeaway here is that, you know, in the Terry Schiavo case and traditionally when these kinds of brain injuries were evaluated medically, the question was, will they get better? And that was the question for the family, and that was the question that families asked doctors, and these were the frustrating questions that couldn't necessarily be answered. But your research suggests that there's another approach, and that is, can someone live in a state where they have access to the outside world using some different kinds of technologies if, as you describe, they are covertly aware? They don't traditionally respond through language, but they still can be reached. We're getting to the point where we can actually answer that question.
We are. And we reported on a patient, for example, last year who had been in a vegetative state for 15 years. And this gentleman, we put him into the scanner on many occasions. And we actually got into a situation where we were having a fairly regular dialogue. We asked him many questions about his life, his situation. We were able to establish that he knew who he was, where he was. He knew how long he'd been there. He had attitudes. He had opinions. We asked him whether he was in any pain, because that's a question that his family were concerned about. And we really didn't know the answer. And of course, we can therapeutically do something about it. Had the answer been yes, we would have given him some painkillers. But fortunately, the answer turned out to be no. So we are entering an era where some of these patients, and I want to emphasize it is a small minority, but nevertheless, there are significant numbers of these patients that are, as you say, covertly aware. We're beginning to detect them, and we're beginning to enter an era where we may be able to communicate with them on a semi-regular basis, which may allow them to contribute to their own therapeutic future, if you like, to make decisions about what happens to them.
Adrian Owen, cognitive neuroscientist and professor at Western University in Ontario, Canada. Adrian, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, scientific propositions get tested. Also, faith gets tested. But those tests are not the same.
My name is Casey from Venus, Texas. As a pagan, my faith has been routinely tested when family and friends have called it evil and even removed themselves from my life. We each have our own path to walk in this world, and if they cannot be at peace with mine, then I am their loss. I send them love and light and move on with my life.
So, folks in the middle of the country really want to talk about this. Here's from Oklahoma. Lately, it feels like my faith is being tested, but I always remember the anecdote of Louis IX of France in a conversation he had with a priest. Two men are asked to defend two castles, one on the war front and one deep in the protected heart of France. In the end, which man is to be honored more, the one who had to fight to defend or the one who had an easy time of it? We'd love to know your thoughts on faith, testing, and the testing of scientific propositions, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or leave a comment at facebook.com/thetakeaway. If you want to sell books and cause an argument, just take a position on the existence of God. Among the most successful titles in publishing over the past decade have been different sides of the God argument. Richard Dawkins, the late Christopher Hitchens, and Roger Penrose have all taken the position that God doesn't exist, science proves it, and that in any case, religion has been a profoundly destructive force in the world. To these titles add numerous pro-God, pro-spirituality, and anti-evolution books of one kind or another, and the battle is joined. This holy war of words tends to set up each writer as a kind of Galileo, preaching against some orthodoxy that will anger the faithful, the scientific, or everything in between. Mathematician Amir Axel has sliced this argument in a way that may anger all sides at once, and he's quite happy about that. His new book is titled Why Science Does Not Disprove God. Double negative there. In the current physics and math, he says there is more than enough mystery to support a spiritual outlook without throwing out a century of Einstein, quarks, and Higgs particles.
I think in my mind I make a distinction between two gods, the gods of organized religions and the god of Einstein, for example. And Einstein used to say things like, subtle is the Lord, but malicious he is not. You know, thinking of God as a kind of an abstraction of the god of Genesis, this old man with a beard who is not malicious but is cantankerous or something like that. And he said things like, I want to know God's thoughts, the rest are details. And to me, Einstein was, in a sense, a believer in some kind of a power behind the universe. And that's the God I'm trying to defend here, not the God of religions.
How do you distinguish between the God that has a consciousness, an intelligence of some kind, versus a God that signifies a creation moment, the idea that something was set in motion that brings us the universe that we live in right now? Those are two different notions of God, one that plans and designs, the other that just initiates a set of conditions.
Well, to me, it's the second God that I'm interested in. If you look at what happened in the first second of the universe, even a fraction of a second, suddenly there's this huge explosion. Well, an explosion doesn't really do anything. And then there's this mass creation through the Higgs. Why would there be creation of mass using the Higgs mechanism, which is so highly mathematical, so complicated? To me, that thought behind it, that's God. And then you have the quark soup that existed when mass was created. There are all these particles, and they're swimming in this plasma, which is this weird fluid. Suddenly, they all bunch in threes. Two ups and a down to make a proton, two downs and an up to make a neutron. That's exactly what's needed to create matter as we know it, with the electrons then going around them in the right way, and the charges when masses work out. The universe is so fine-tuned. There has to be something behind it that made it that way.
Although you'd have to rewrite Genesis pretty significantly. In the beginning, there was dark upon the waters, and then there was the soup, and then you quarks go up and you guys go down, and it would be a very different story.
Right. It was written for very primitive people, but what I like about Genesis is it does say that there was a creation to the universe. Cosmologists, physicists at that time, from 1917 to 1929, when Hubble discovered the expansion of the universe, believed the universe has always been there. Well, Genesis tells us that it was created at a certain point. Now, is it 7 days or 6 days or whatever? Of course not.
What can scientists help people of the book do, and what can religionists help scientists understand if they share a little more?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I tried to trace in the book the history of religion and science, and to me, at the beginning, they were very close. Many of the early scientists were religious. Galileo, his daughter was a nun, and he never really tried to argue that religion was wrong. He just said, look, the earth rotates, and all the rest of the things he was discovering. And it's really the literal interpretation of scripture that gets us in trouble. In the 21st century, I'd like to see the scientist or the atheistic scientist really stay on what science is designed to do, which is to understand nature and not to jump to conclusions that are not warranted. If you look at data statistically, you can't really disprove that there's something beyond the universe. Some people call it God. Maybe we should let them do that.
One of the things you would learn in probably the first session of a science class in your undergraduate college career would be that propositions like why science does not disprove God does not constitute a proof for God. It may be the case that you can't disprove that there's a God, but that is not an argument for the existence of God. How do you deal with that?
Right. Despite what you may read in many sites on the internet, I'm not proving, nor do I pretend to prove, the existence of God. All I'm saying is I'm trying to point out that these very well-known atheists who claim science has proven there is no God. Science says so. The math says so. The equations say so. Physics says so. Biology says so. Look, that's just not true. That's where I stop.
How do you deal with this argument? And it's one of the arguments you talk about in your book, and it's very much in vogue right now as physicists grapple with the string theory and the question of dark matter, multiverses, that we live in the universe that we're in because basically we live in the universe we're in. We're a part of that universe. We can only see certain things. So our universe looks like this because it's the only universe we could ever possibly see. There may be a million other things out there, but we can't see them. That's just the way it is.
That's a compelling argument. If you stretch it further, it can really imply, it's called the entropic principle that, you know, you see what you can't see. You live where you can live. We obviously can't live on Mars or Venus because that's where the conditions are right for us here. This universe is the right universe for us. Maybe there are other universes, but we have no way of connecting with them. But that argument that there are other universes and other possibilities, that's really the power of infinity. And I object to that in the book because to me it's very hard to talk about infinity, and once you invoke infinity it's like monkeys typing Hamlet. Anything can happen and you can prove that mathematically.
Do you believe in God?
That's a tough one. I don't believe in any God of the Western religions. I believe in some kind of a power underlying and extending beyond the universe. Does that power intervene in our everyday lives? That's hard to think that way because statistics proves that it probably doesn't happen. But in a sense, I like a lot something that a French physicist said by name was Wern. He said, our consciousness is much more advanced than those of dogs and monkeys. Can we really believe that there's nothing in the universe whose consciousness is greater than ours in the same proportion, let's say? And I believe in that. I believe there's a consciousness in the universe and the power in the universe that we haven't yet uncovered that you may choose to call God.
Why Science Does Not Disprove God. It's the title of the latest book from Amir Axel, who's the author of Fermat's Last Theorem. And thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Really, it was a pleasure.
A thought before we go about eternity for someone who knows something about it. After spending 19 years in prison, wrongly convicted of a triple murder, middleweight boxing champion Reuben Hurricane Carter was released in 1985 after anthems like this one from Bob Dylan championed his cause. He died this weekend in Toronto at the age of 76 of prostate cancer. Eternity begins now for the Hurricane. Love to know your thoughts on this or anything on the program, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or check out thetakeaway.org for all our stories and much, much more. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Reputation.com. With tools to help businesses and professionals manage online reviews and control search results. Introducing reputation scoring for businesses. More at 1-800-REPUTATION or at reputation.com. TiVo, maker of the TiVo Romeo. Bringing cable TV and streaming apps together in one unified and searchable experience. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.